Okay, I would like to summarize this by saying that as one moves through these stages, through these seven biological responses, and their seven corresponding states of consciousness, ultimately one experiences the ecstasy of spirit, which is the goal of all seeking. The goal of all seeking is to experience bliss consciousness. The goal of all seeking is to overcome the fear of death. The goal of all seeking is to truly find your identity. And the spiritual tradition says, especially our spiritual tradition, is when you experience that, you experience a form of ecstasy that is so superior to any form of ecstasy you could get in the material world. And that ecstasy has three components. It has a physical component, it has a mythical component, and it has a sacred component. Physical component means even through your five senses, everything gives you the experience of ecstasy. Sound. You hear a sound, it throws you into ecstasy. You touch something, it throws you into ecstasy. You smell a beautiful flower, it throws you into ecstasy. There's this great story of Ramakrishna. One day he was doing puja to the Divine Mother and he suddenly went into ecstasy. And for 3 days he didn't stop dancing because he couldn't control himself. He was in God consciousness. And then after that he never came out of it. It was the true example of what we call ecstasy at the level of the senses, physical. Mythical means you are in touch with the divine energies. Mythology, remember I said Mata, Matrika, measurement, Maya, they are all expressions of the mythical domain of gods and goddesses. And then sacred ecstasy, which is the direct experience of God. So when we have physical ecstasy, we have mythical ecstasy, we have sacred ecstasy, then we have found true freedom. Everything else becomes unimportant. One of the reasons I got into mind-body medicine myself was that when I was training, I used to take care of addiction. And I found that addiction is a very difficult disease to treat. But I also discovered that people who have addiction are actually very spiritual people. They're looking for ecstasy. They're just not looking for it in the right way. I remember I had a patient who was on a respirator for 3 weeks with chronic obstructive lung disease. I weaned him off the respirator and 2 days later I found him smoking through his tracheostomy tube. You know, he couldn't let go. I had alcoholic patients who would come out of alcoholic coma, go back to drinking. And I asked myself, what is this deep addiction, what's the reason for these deep addictions? And I found, actually, if you look at spiritual literature, you will find that actually the very reason to incarnate, the very reason you are here in this domain of space, time and matter is because you are addicted. Everybody in this room is addicted to something. Because if you weren't, you wouldn't even incarnate. Okay? Incarnation is a result of addiction. And the only cure of this addiction is to find true spiritual ecstasy. There is no way otherwise that one doesn't incarnate because we are addicted to something or the other. There's a beautiful, you know, in 1945 in the Egyptian desert, somebody found these documents that go back to biblical times. And there's one document that is attributed to Solomon, who is the son of David, one of the old prophets of the Old Testament. And he talks about physical ecstasy and mythical ecstasy and sacred ecstasy. So, of course, this has been always part of our tradition, bliss consciousness, Satchitanand, that it is true bliss consciousness. But other people have discovered it also in other parts of the world. Because this document, this person, I don't know who he is, but this document was written about 6,000 years ago. And this is what it says. He's speaking to God. And this person says, you split me and you tore my heart open and you filled me with love. You poured your spirit into mine. I knew you as I know myself. My eyes are radiant with your light. My ears delight in your music. My nostrils are filled with your fragrance. My face is covered with your dew. You have made me see all things shining. You have made me see all things new. You have granted me perfect ease. I have become like paradise. And having become like paradise, my soul is healed. That's a description of physical ecstasy, of mythical ecstasy, of sacred ecstasy. That's a description of true Sat Chit Anand. And that's where we are all going, whether we know it or not. Now I would like to end this evening session by talking to you about not only personal transformation, but about collective transformation. Because right now the world situation is terrible. But there's also an opportunity. And one of the best examples to look at collective transformation is the process in biology that is called metamorphosis. I think if you're familiar with biology, you know what metamorphosis is, when something like a caterpillar becomes a butterfly. The two are quite different. A caterpillar is like a worm. A butterfly is a very magical creature with beautiful colors that flies. This is what happens. At a certain point in its development, a caterpillar becomes very greedy. It starts to consume more than it needs. And when its consumption exceeds its metabolic needs, the caterpillar's body starts to die. And it starts to liquefy. But within the body of the caterpillar, there are a few cells here and there that scientists refer to as the imaginal cells. Imaginal cells. Because these imaginal cells are dreaming a new reality. Literally. These imaginal cells, they vibrate in a different frequency of consciousness. And when the caterpillar's body recognizes these imaginal cells, they attack them. The immune cells of the caterpillar, they attack the imaginal cells. But because the imaginal cells are vibrating at a different frequency, they remain immune to the onslaught. Soon the immune cells give up, and then what happens is the imaginal cells start to gather in little clusters. A cluster here, a cluster here, a cluster here, a cluster here. And then something else happens. The imaginal cell clusters, they start to connect with each other. So this cluster of imaginal cells connects with this cluster of imaginal cells, which connects with this cluster of imaginal cells. And when the connectivity of the imaginal cells reaches a critical mass, a critical threshold, then something magical happens. A gene, a genetic code that has been lying dormant in the body of the caterpillar, it wakes up. And in that genetic code is the information for wings, is the information for a new heart, the information for antenna, the information for legs, the information for a new metabolic rate, because the metabolic rate of a flying creature has to be different from the metabolic rate of a worm. All that is coded in the gene. And the gene which was sleeping wakes up because of the connectivity of the imaginal cells. And as the rest of the body of the caterpillar starts to die, then the imaginal cells, they start to use the dying carcass of the caterpillar as their nutritive soup. It becomes the culture medium that the imaginal cells use to grow and to connect. And soon, a butterfly emerges with the flight to freedom. And the reason I tell you this story, there are two reasons. One is that right in this room, you are the imaginal cells. Because you are saying, we don't want the old reality. We want a new reality. Like you, there are many imaginal cells today on this earth. people who are saying, it's no longer tolerable that we have so much injustice in the world, that we have so much poverty, that we fight to solve our problems, that we are destroying our planet. We want to imagine a new reality for ourselves. And we know that we can do it. And like you, there are imaginal cells. In fact, even your organization has imaginal cells all over the world. The next step is to connect. The same gene that codes for the wings of the butterfly, the same gene codes for the beating of the human heart. It looks like, and this is a true biological example, that a gene was discovered 300 million years ago, and God said, I'll keep it and I'll put it in the human heart, because in the human heart is the longing for a new reality. And all this terrorism, all these disasters, this is the nutritive soup of the dying carcass of the old paradigm. Because if it wasn't there, the yearning would not be there. So please, start to imagine the new reality. Because through you and through your transformation, the world will be transformed. Mahatma Gandhi used to say, there is no way to peace, peace is the way. And Mahatma Gandhi also said, can you be the change that you wish to see in the world? Because in your transformation is the transformation of the world. So I'm asking you to go to a website, and the website is Peace Practices. There are seven practices: being peace, thinking peace, feeling peace, speaking peace, acting peace, sharing peace, and celebrating peace. And let us all do it. Because if we do it in consciousness even, we will transform the world. And the organization, this beautiful organization that you have, given me a great privilege to be part of you, you are the leaders that can bring about this transformation. Let's not waste our consciousness, which is so powerful, because through this consciousness, we are now on the brink of transformation, where culture and humanity and compassion and love will dominate the world, and militarism will be obsolete. Thank you very much.
This was a mind-boggling, mind-expanding, yet consciousness-enhancing experience. One day with Dr. Deepak Chopra could probably transform the lives of millions, like the seedlings who are sitting here, who could further on become the seeds for others.
What is your daily routine activity? My activity is that I meditate for 2 hours in the morning, and I exercise every morning, and I don't take myself seriously, and my wife and my children don't take me seriously, and that's the reason of my success. How do you get free of anger, attachment, desire? Actually, anytime you feel angry, feel your body. So anytime you have what is called a toxic emotion, just feel your body, and you'll recognize that the body doesn't feel very good. And that's the first step. Anytime you have, let's go into this a little bit. You know, we have the most toxic emotions are anger or hostility, fear, guilt, and depression. And the reason they occur is not because we, you know, the question as it is phrased, how do we get rid of this? That's just the very fact that you want to get rid of something makes it stronger. If I tell you, don't think of pink elephants, what do you think of? Same thing with desire. If I tell you, don't desire such and such, you will keep thinking of how not to desire such and such, and you'll end up desiring it. So, the reason why we have toxic emotions of any kind is that we try to suppress them. And anytime you suppress something, it usually builds up as toxic energy. When you have any emotion, which we call turbulent, which is toxic, you know, love is not a toxic emotion. Love is a life-enhancing emotion. So is compassion. So is forgiveness. But when you have an emotion like anger, hostility, fear, guilt, depression, it's usually because you have actually not fully embraced a painful experience. Now, as we go through life, we have to, it's normal to experience both physical and psychological pain. If you did not experience pain, in fact, your body would get very diseased. Pain is a way of telling you to get on balance. So when we don't embrace our pain and we don't get in touch with it, when we deny our pain or we suppress our pain, then it gets built up as a toxic emotion. What we call anger is remembered pain that was not fully experienced in the past. So it's a certain situation brings it out in the present as anger. What we call fear is anticipation of pain in the future because we did not know how to deal with it in the past. Guilt is the direction of pain back at yourself because you say it's all my fault. And then depression is the depletion of energy that happens as a result of anger, hostility, fear and guilt. So in a way, all these toxic emotions are really the result of not getting in touch with pain, emotional pain. The way you avoid emotional toxicity is that the first thing is you witness your pain. So when you have a painful experience, you witness it. And how do you witness it? You witness the pain inside your body. So, why don't you close your eyes right now and let me show you something. Think of something that may have happened in the last 3 weeks or maybe last month or last 3 months that made you upset. If you can't think of something in the last 3 months, maybe in the last 6 months. And if you can't think of anything in the last 6 months, then you can come on the stage and then do the rest of this course. So, I hope everyone can think of something that got them upset. Okay, so if you're thinking of something that got you upset now, as you're thinking of it, think of what happened. What was the conversation? Who said what to whom? Relive the whole experience. And when you start to reliving the whole experience, then you see, start to feel your body and you will see that that painful emotion is localized somewhere in your body. And then when you localize it in your body, identify it, give it a word. What is it you're experiencing? Anger? Fear? What is it you're experiencing? Okay, so now you can open your eyes. So, how many people, as they were thinking of the painful experience, emotional pain, they felt something in the body? Okay? So, can anyone tell me what they felt and where?
I felt a pain in my right precordium.
In your right precordium. And what is the label you would give it? What was it? Emotional label?
Anger.
Okay. Anybody else? Huh? Left forehead. And what is the label? Guilt. Anybody else? Hurt. Where did you feel it? Heart. Stomach. Okay. Anybody else? Your respiratory rate increased. Okay. And what was the label? Anger.
I felt cheated.
Felt cheated. And where was the experience? In the body, in the heart. Anybody else? Okay, here. Yes? Okay. So actually, anger, where? Heart. So anytime you have any of these so-called toxic emotions, they localize, okay? And they localize mostly in one of the chakras. Fear localizes here, anger and hostility localize here, and if the experience has been very long, then it starts going elsewhere. And ultimately it spills into the rest of the body. But usually it localizes in the beginning in these chakras, okay? So those are the first three steps. You relive the experience, you localize it in the body, and you give it a label. Now, you try not to give it a label of victimization. So when he said cheated, that's a label of victimization. To say hurt, angry, hostility, upset, fear, guilt, anxiety, all this is fine. These are primary emotions. But when you say cheated, abandoned, abused, then you're using a language that it was somebody else's fault. There's nothing wrong with that. It might be somebody else's fault. But then you have to wait for that person to change till you feel better. So that means you might be waiting for a long time. Okay, so it's better not to use that language. Use language that says, I'm not going to be a victim. This is my pain and this is what I have to deal with it. Witness, localize, label. Third step is you express it. And how do you express it? You write it down. This is what happened. This is, you know, this is the whole situation. I felt like this, so and so said this, 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 this. You first write it using your own interpretation of what happened. Then you rewrite it, and this time you imagine that you were the other person. And you use that other person's interpretation of what happened. Okay, just for, as an exercise. You say, okay, I felt like this, but this other person, maybe this is their interpretation. Because, you know, anytime you have an argument with somebody, they have a different interpretation. So try and figure out what that interpretation is. Just through your imagination. And then do it a third time. This time, use a neutral interpretation. You know, you're writing for Times of India. Okay, so you say, this is what happened. So first you express it in the first person, then you express it in the second person, and then you express it in the third person. All to yourself. Piece of paper. First step, you took responsibility, you localized it, you defined it, you labeled it, now you express it. Then you ask yourself the question, if I hold on to this, what is the advantage? What's the advantage in holding on to this? And what's the advantage in letting it go? And if you ask yourself the honest question, it'll always tell you, your soul will tell you, there's no advantage to holding it. Okay? So you say, I'm going to let it go. Then you do a ritual to let it go. Why do you do a ritual? Because ritual helps to release the energy. Okay? So you do a puja. Okay? You do a puja, or you do some breathing exercise, or do you havan, or some ritual you do, and say, now I'm bringing it closure, you take that piece of paper, you burn it, and you throw it to the wind. You release it, through ritual. After you've released it, then you share the experience with somebody you love, with somebody you can trust. Each step takes the energy less and less and less. You share it, and once you have shared it, then you move on, and you celebrate. You don't lock it inside your body. That's how you deal with fear, with anger, with guilt, with depression. Now somebody said, what about desire? I have a different take on desire. Because my feeling is that the more you suppress your desire, the more pathological it becomes. So you cannot suppress desire. It's impossible. Everybody says suppress desire, but it doesn't happen. Okay? What you can do with desire is either you can transmute your desire into another desire, or you can transcend the desire. You can transmute it, you can transcend it. Transmute it, it transforms into a higher desire. So instead of restricting the desire, you expand the desire. My guru used to say, expand your desires till nothing satisfies you except God, because that's the highest desire. So you not suppress it. You say, what's a desire that will give me bigger fulfillment than this desire? we are a hierarchy of desires. The first level of desire is very basic. You know, it has to do with survival. All sexual desire, other desires, they are basic instincts for survival. That's why we have them. Okay, so the first level is survival. The second level is achievement. The third level is love and belongingness. The fourth level is self-esteem. The fifth level is creativity. The sixth level is higher consciousness. The seventh level is God. So I don't even call these lower desires. They're not lower desires, they're earlier desires. And some people, if they suppress their earlier desires totally, they manifest later as pathology. So always say, how can I move from this level to this level? Once I move from this level, how can I move from this level to this level? It's just a matter of reinterpreting how you expand your desire instead of constrict your desire. And the more you expand your desire, the higher it becomes, the more it transmutes the energy of the earlier desire to the highest level of desire. Okay. What was the other question? Does it make sense? Explain tsunami, why calamities like this take place. Okay, by the way, I don't know what does anyone know what time Larry King shows here on CNN? Anybody watch that program? What time does it show in India? 8 o'clock in the morning? On what time? 2 o'clock? Okay, so this Saturday on 2 p.m. I'm on CNN talking about this question. Okay, if you want to watch it. How do you interpret the tsunami? Okay, if you are in the fight-flight response, you say God is punishing us for our sins. If you are in the reactive response, you say it's a geological thing and we have to take care of it, understand it scientifically. If you're in the restful awareness response, you say, you know, does the planet have a consciousness which is linked to my consciousness? If you have the intuitive response, you say, what's the link between me and my consciousness? Is the turbulence in our collective consciousness also reflected in nature's consciousness? Because nature also has a spirit. Okay, in every tradition, including our tradition, we say, there is spirit in everything. In the American Indians say there's spirit in everything. There's spirit in plants, there's spirit in rocks, and they call that the spirit of place. The spirit of place. Does human consciousness affect the spirit of place? If we are collectively turbulent, does our collective turbulent cause turbulence in the spirit of nature? Because after all, if there's only one consciousness that is differentiated into the activity of nature and the activity of our biological organism, then our collective turbulence can be reflected in the turbulence that we call tsunami. Also, there are other things, you know, the tidal waves are part of global warming. Global warming is human behavior. It's depletion of natural resources, depletion of the ozone layer. So, there is an inseparability between the behavior of biological organisms and the disturbance of the ecosystem and what we call turbulence in nature. Now, in our Indian tradition, they used to say that one way of handling these is when we collectively go into deep silence, into meditation, then our consciousness calming down calms down the consciousness of our planet. And, you know, there's a theory in the West these days. It's called Gaia theory. Gaia is the name of a Greek goddess. And so planet Earth is referred to as Gaia. Our planet is actually a living organism. It's a biological organism. And Gaia has consciousness. And when we are troubled, then nature is also troubled. When we are peaceful, then nature is always peaceful. And in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, Patanjali says, when you are perfectly established in peace consciousness, then everything around you becomes peaceful. When you are perfectly established in non-violence, then everything around you ceases to feel hostility. So our collective meditation could actually calm the turbulence of the ecosystem. Also, when we do yajnas and havans and, you know, all these rituals that people used to do in the past, but they did it with precise knowledge of consciousness. How you transcend, then you take the appropriate mantras and sutras, you introduce vibrations which are transforming vibrations of consciousness in nature. So there's a role for yajna, there's a role for havan, there's a role for puja, there's a role for meditation in balancing the ecosystem. But not as an empty ritual, you know, you just repeat the sutra, mantra and gone. That's not what real yajna is. Your consciousness is linked to the consciousness of the universe, and in that consciousness you introduce sankalp. When you do that, you can actually transform what's happening in nature. So tsunami has many explanations. At the level of fight-flight, God is upset with me. At the level of reactivity, it's a geological phenomenon, I need to deal with it scientifically. At the level of intuition, what's the role of my consciousness with the consciousness of the planet? At the level of creativity, what can I do with this disaster and make something better out of it? What can I do? One thing I can do is, you see now the global compassion that is occurring, where people in Sri Lanka are losing their differences between Hindu and Muslim and Buddhist because shared suffering is making them see their common humanity. What is compassion? Compassion is when we share our suffering and we go beyond our localized identity. Religious identity, national identity, these are artificial identities. You know, what's his name? Einstein used to say nationalism is an infantile disease. It's the measles of humanity. Krishnamurti used to say nationalism is tribalism. Eric Fromm used to say nationalism is our form of incest. It's idolatry. Patriotism is a cult. So, you know, it's very tribal to think in those terms. And when a big disaster happens, people automatically lose that identity. They go beyond their identity to a common identity and say, what can we do for humanity? Maybe we can't do today anything about the tsunami, but we can stop the violence of man to man. You know, if one bomb in Hiroshima killed 200,000 people in 1 second, why don't we see what is that kind of inhumanity that we can get rid of? Why do we have to have 23 million people dying in war since 1945? Is this a call from nature that we at least cease our humanity? So there's a creative response. There's a visionary response which says, you know, the tsunami is a message that we need to move to a bigger vision where we see our globalization not through commercial interests, but globalization through compassion. So on every level, there's a different interpretation of the tsunami. At the level of unity response, how can I get in touch with the source of creation? So the tsunami, I can see, is a manifestation of our collective consciousness. Say that again. Okay. So there's another interpretation. But see, the animals did not suffer, huh? The animals sensed it. Because their consciousness is more in touch. Because of simplicity. Because there's no separation. We are part, animals are part of nature. And they see themselves as part of nature. The more we alienate ourselves from nature, the more distant we become from nature, the more we are living in fear and not tuned in to the forces and elements. Yes? Sure, of course. Please.
Particularly in
Well, it depends on the state of consciousness of the patient. You see, if the patient is totally accepting that consciousness is a field of all possibilities, well, there, I think then I can't, not knowing the case, I can't consult with you, but what you can always ask yourself a question, am I increasing well-being or am I increasing suffering? Then that's the way to go. You make the best choice. You should do that anyway. You should do that anyway, irrespective of what surgical procedure you do, because it'll help. Okay. I don't know. Can't answer your question. Well, you know, they say that the mystery of karma is not fully fathomable on the level of the intellect. There is personal karma, there's collective karma, there's karma from past experiences, past lives. So who knows? It's too mysterious.
We will request you, you know, there are many questions which have been written by people. They have done some, they have put in some effort, so we'll try and answer some of them. Should I read it out to you? There are many linked questions about soul restoration. Why is it so difficult? And the existence of soul, is it real or not? And can soul exist everywhere? And how about soul taking rebirth?
I think I spent the whole day talking about those things. Huh? Didn't I not? This is a good question, okay? So what he says, certain people, like Buddha for example, he spoke of the non-self nature of objects. And he said that there is no such thing as an individual self. Now, the more you start to look into that, the more you begin to understand that it's actually semantics. What we say in Vedanta is Atman is Brahman, right? So Atman and Brahman are the same thing. There's no individual self. What is the individual self? The individual self, which we call Jiva, is actually it's an artifact. It's like when I see the wave on the ocean. If I see a wave on the ocean, I say, that's a wave, that's an individual wave. I take a photograph and I bring it to you and I say, see this beautiful wave? You say, let's go and see it. We go see it, it's not there anymore. Okay, so impermanence in time and non-self nature of object is the same thing. So both Buddha and Vedanta are right. There is no individual self. There's only a universal self pretending to be an individual self. Okay, and that's what realization is. Realization is when you recognize that your Atman and Brahman is the same thing. That a wave is a pattern of behavior of the ocean. The wave has no individual identity. It has only an individual identity for a fraction of a moment when I take the picture. Okay, but that is an artifact. By the time I develop the picture, it's gone. Okay, so too, what we call Jiva is an artifact. It's a transient pattern of behavior of Atman, which is the same as Brahman. And the whole goal of moksha or enlightenment is to go beyond that. So they're all right. Now what is reincarnation? What reincarnates? What reincarnates is wisps of memory and threads of desire. Not an individual self. Wisps of memory and threads of desire become morphogenetic fields of information and energy that manifest as space-time events. So what incarnates is a pattern of behavior. In physics, we call it collapse of wave function. So when your wave function collapses once, takes on a particular pattern, the next time it collapses, it takes on the similar pattern. It becomes like a habit in nature. And, you know, the statistical probability of collapse of wave function follows laws of probability in quantum physics. So there is incarnation as an experience. You know, everything is an experience. As an experience, there is an incarnation. There's a pattern of behavior of the universe that is this person who asked me the question. And this person, as long as this person is in the wheel of samsara, it will continue to experience reincarnation and birth and death. But once it gets rid of that samskara, the avidya is gone, it will realize that there was no such thing. There was only the universal. Same pattern. There is no such thing as a person. Yeah, but there is no such thing as a person. A person, what we call a person, is a pattern of behavior of the infinite. It was all God. It was all one universal consciousness doing those cycles of incarnation and reincarnation.
A whole lot of personal question to Dr. Deepak Chopra.
Personal love, good. Doctor, thodi kar rahe.
No, about your level of consciousness.
No, I don't answer personal. I don't answer personal.
Okay. How about having an idea? How about the idea of having a school propagating your philosophy?
I think the moment you start institutionalizing anything, you create a dogma and ideology, and knowledge should be free and flowing and evolving and continuous. And after I go, there'll be other people who'll improve it and take it to a new level. So I don't think there should be a school.
We will restrict it to this, please.
Okay, one.
We will restrict it because then we keep going round and round.
It's called precognition. When you are in the field of non-locality, then past, present and future is all inseparably a pattern. So, you know, like if I'm playing a CD on my disc, let's say I have a CD. CD has track 1, track 2, track 3, track 4. What I'm hearing right now is the track that I'm playing. But in the CD are all these other tracks. So some people have the ability to shift into the different locations in the field where past, present and future are all one. It's called the Akashic record. He switched into that state of consciousness. That's all.
Two questions. How to get rid of vices and explain guilt. I think you
are... I explained guilt and I explained the other two, yes.
Okay. If healing is only spiritual, how come so many surgeries are taking place? Is it market forces?
If healing is only spiritual, how come so many surgeries... Palliative, you know, if you have a discomfort and you have some tumor which is blocking your breathing, you have to get rid of it. So there's a role for everything. What I mean by healing ultimately is healing involves even the loss of fear of death. You're not healed till you lose your fear of death. So healing is much more profound than treatment.
How often you go into ecstasy and how about you after you know God?
Always, all the time.
I think that about sums it up of most of the issues that people wanted to speak.
Okay, one last question here.
Sir, what is that first thing which inspired you to become a spiritual leader?
You know, I don't think of myself as a spiritual leader. I think of myself as exploring consciousness the way somebody else explores Mount Everest, or somebody else explores the ocean. I think it's an inner urge to share what is happening inside you with other people. Okay?
I'll request Dr. Ashok Mehta, who is the medical director of Global Hospital, an oncosurgeon by profession, to please come and give a vote of thanks to Dr. Deepak Chopra for sharing his entire day, his thoughts, and his expanded level of consciousness with us. Dr. Ashok Mehta, please.
I must tell you that I have never been so spellbound as of today. I think Dr. Deepak Chopra has taken us on a flight, the flight of the unknown. Known but reinterpreted in a very scientific way. When he speaks, we feel that he is just playing with pebbles. I cannot still come out of the spell under which he has put the entire audience. I can only say, Dr. Deepak Chopra, you have stirred our inner consciousness. As we were talking, Dr. Pratap Mida was telling me, we have been discussing for last couple of years that we should have an association of physicians interested in spirituality across the board. And if we have your blessings, maybe you may not have your school, but this may be the right time to begin, and if you can bless us, then maybe we will write to all of you and form that small association, which may be in the seed stage, but with the blessings of the person of the eminence of Dr. Chopra, it will really grow into a big tree. Once again, I want to thank Dr. Deepak Chopra and of course Mrs. Chopra and his son and daughter-in-law for finding time to spend a whole day with us, traveling all the way from New Delhi, and he's going to return tonight. Two nights in a train and one day with us. I am almost certain that he will come again. Our dadis have given him a blessing, asked him to go soon and come soon. Dr. Chopra also has much larger things to do in this world. He wants to bring about a global awareness of world peace and work towards that goal for the rest of his beautiful life. And we all almost feel that Brahma Kumaris may be a good companion group for his work and will really help a long way to have that propagation of his ideals of world peace. Somebody said we should give you a standing ovation. May I request all of you to give a standing ovation. I think besides thanking Dr. Chopra, I must thank all of you. I don't think we could have a better audience than the cream of the medical profession and also many other professionals who are here. Once again, I thank you, Dr. Chopra. And of course, I would like also to thank Banarasi Bhai for organizing such a beautiful meeting. Once again, thank you all.
I'm going to request Nirvair Bhai, our senior most brother, to please come up on the stage. The visit of Dr. Deepak Chopra is not only etched in our memories, but it's also in print, and we have your album ready for the entire day. So we would like to gift you with the memories that you can take back with you. I'll request Brijbon Bhai to please also come up on the dais. Brijbon Bhai, please. Please remain seated. There are one or two announcements, and before we part, please remain seated. The photograph, the group photograph which we had taken about 4 hours back, is already ready, and you can take it from the conference office. It has come out very well. Next to the photography, next to the conference office in the same building, as you go down, the photography department, you can take it from there. And all those who were not present yesterday evening and who could not take the gifts from the dadis can remain seated, and just after this session they can have the gifts. We'll let you know by tomorrow. This is Rita Chopra. Request Dr. H.K. Chopra, can you please accompany her? Is Mr. Gautam and Dr. Janice there? Gautam? Dr. Janice, please come. Inspiration behind the man himself. Can we give them an ovation, please? Please continue to remain seated, and we'll have 1 minute silence before we end this session.
Silence. surely find. And that's a love that takes us all, and everyone that you see. It's your destiny, you gather all around, coming back to your sweet home.